Let's see, I'm not sure what would be the best title for the lecture tonight, but something in the nature, naturalistic science is poor science. An area that I haven't given anything on quite in this way before, I think. I think most of us know who have attended the Farrell House lectures, we have wrestled with modern man's dilemma, is expressed as we often would express it here in the concept of Jean-Paul Sartre, that man is dead. Or as we would picture, as pictured in Britain, where I've just given this lecture, by Francis Bacon's paintings, of mankind alienated from everything else within a glass cage, yet screaming inside of that glass cage. Francis Bacon likes to paint the Pope in this situation, as you would picture as man's pomp and pride, yet alienated from other men and alienated from any meaning, still screaming. Or you could think of Dylan Thomas's poetry, which is so beautiful that it's difficult to read it without weeping, and yet has the same concept of meaninglessness and hopelessness. Or the thing I've quoted from time to time of John Osborne, the playwright, who could be called and who has been called an idealist, who hasn't ever been able to find an ideal. All these things are modern man's expression of his own dilemma, the deadness of man. The thing that I've used not as much, but a little bit recently, is Charlie Parker, the bandman, and the expression that he expresses, endless variations on a theme that no one can ever find. The area of painting, thing that I've used a great deal, of Modrian coming to the place of making his furniture to fit the unity of his picture after taking the frame off the picture and never putting one on. And that this room then constitutes a real unity, the picture with the furniture, and yet at the same time, the room being utterly spoiled whenever anybody entered the room. In other words, that there's room for everything in this rather nicely balanced unity apart from man. Or, again, in the thing I've used a great deal of Picasso becoming almost a god on his canvas by using that which is completely disassociated with the limitations of the external world, and yet at the moment when by abstraction he has been able to seem to make a universal on his canvas, yet at that given moment losing communication with the man in front of the canvas, and so man is destroyed. All these things are in the same direction. When we speak of modern man's dilemma as seeing man is dead, of course this does not mean that man once was alive and now has died, any more than we would find Nietzsche and those who follow him in the statement that God is dead, meaning that God ever lived and now is died. This isn't the idea with either of these, God is dead or man is dead. It is that anyone who ever thought man was alive or anyone who ever thought God was alive were living in illusion. That God never was living is what Nietzsche meant. And modern man, when he says man is dead, means that all of man's longings to be different on the basis of those things that distinguish man from other things, such as real significance and love and morality and these other things, that they've always been an illusion, that they never really have existed at all. In other words, that man has thought he was man through the centuries and millenniums, but in reaction, he has always been a machine. And deterministic concept here of the machinery. So man has always had an illusion concerning of what he has been, is the idea. This is modern man's dilemma as expressed in these other areas. In other words, that in these areas we've just spoken of, and often lecture about, and talk about, and discuss here in Farrell House and La Brie, there is no place for man in the modern world. Or you can say it in the positive, all is a machine. There is a closed circuit, a closed unity of cause and effect, and man himself is caught in this closed field of cause and effect, mechanical cause and effect. So that love only becomes a physical sexual relationship, and then that's all. And that morals, on the other hand, only become society's way of making you do what society wants you to do. So morals becomes an instrument of merely keeping a form to society, of manipulating the individual and manipulating you, I would say, and love disappears in this area as being only an illusion tied up to the sexual act and therefore the continuity of biological structure of man, and that's all. Now we could ask, how did we come to this place? And usually here at Labrie, we deal with a philosophic background. But tonight I want to deal with a different area, and that is thinking of it from the viewpoint of science. I'd like to read parts of a third program lecture that was given on the BBC sometime early this year. It appeared in the Listener of February 10, 1966. In other words, just about a month ago, a little bit more than a month ago, this appeared in the BBC Listener. It's called Our Changing Society, Scientific Theories. It is by H.R. Post, who it says gives this talk on tradition in the new. And H.R. Post is reader in the philosophy of science at the Chelsea College of Science and Technology. H.R. Post. It's important to notice that he is in the field of the philosophy of science. After a short introductory paragraph, anybody who would want to read this, they could get it and read it, although I will leave out only the highly technical parts or the repetitive parts and carry on to give the drift of this article in the passages which I read. The first heading, first subheading, is Unique Human Activity. Now, he's not saying that man is unique. That isn't his idea. But here is a human activity which is unique. And what he's saying this is science, in contrast to other things. In science, of all human activities, we can judge most fairly. There is at least one relatively trivial criteria of success in a scientific theory. It should agree with the facts. Very startling statement, actually. We reject a theory, I added that instead of being a startling statement. That isn't part of the reading. To read on, we reject a theory that fails in this respect. In other words, now I'm filling in here. We reject a scientific theory that does not agree with the facts. Now, this really is very startling, and I want to talk about how startling it is just a little further on. Now I'll begin to read, pick up, read again. Even this criterion is not entirely trivial, and philosophers of science, the science critics, have shown its difficulties. Judged by it, science is possibly unique among human activities in being progressive. We welcome a theory that enlarges the area of agreement with fact, where the previous theory either failed or was silent. We are continually progressing to more and more successful theories. Now, that is this paragraph, and I'd just like to add here, this is very remarkable, because there are a lot of young scientists today who don't function on this basis at all. But it also raises a whole series of questions. It raises the question, why, in working in the material universe, and working not just in the material universe, but the total phenomena before man, why is it that it's progressive? And immediately you can think of it in two different ways, that man just has been clever in producing progressive theories. But as he goes on and shows, that won't do. Because after all, what man is doing is not choosing random ideas, like some Greek metaphysical system that doesn't necessarily touch anything, but in the midst of the progression, that is, going into greater and greater areas of unity, the remarkable thing is that what man is doing is not making it up out of whole cloth, but rather going deeper into the universe itself, which is very startling. That you can go deeper into the universe, and the deeper you go into universe, the more you come to unity instead of chance. Or as you progress, you cover more and more particulars on the basis of more and more simple unities. And you must see now, you must understand, this is very different from just spinning a metaphysical system separated from history and time and space, as one might say some of the Greeks have done. This is simply taking the universe as it is about us and progressing deeper into it, the remarkable thing is, instead of coming to chaos, you come to always increasing order. Now, none of this ought to be trivial, because it's fantastic. Why should it be so? Now to go on, skip a little bit and pick up reading again. And this is under the subheading, Two Revolutions. We have had two great revolutions in physics in the first third of this century. I'll stop there for a moment and interject. You remember we have talked to Max Planck's last essays, where he says, we've moved the screen back twice in this generation. Well, these two great revolutions that this man's going to talk about, H.R. Post, are the same things that Max Planck had mentioned in moving the screen back twice in our generation in the area of physics. I'll just start this section again, since I've only read one sentence, and read on. We have had two great revolutions in physics in the first third of this century. There have been great advances in biology since then, but nothing comparable to relativity theory or quantum mechanics has been achieved in natural science since 1935. The startling aspect of these two revolutions is that they prove Newton's mechanics to be wrong. After all, Newton's mechanics had been held to be true, and by some obviously true, for 200 years. This shock has had a big effect, and in my opinion a somewhat undue effect, on philosophers of science, though not on scientists. The effect of Einstein's revolution on these philosophers resembles the effect of the success of Impressionism on art critics. In both cases, the moral drawn seems to have been, from now on, anything goes. No claim to be a work of art is to be rejected. Any revolution is to be welcomed at any time. To quote an extreme philosopher of science, metaphysical systems which contradict observational results or well-confirmed theories are most welcome, end of quote. And I'll stop reading. Now, that's a solid paragraph. Now, this is very interesting, because what he says is that here you have these great revolutions in science has caused certain philosophers to look at science, and philosophers of science, but also philosophers looking at science, and he says it's had an undue effect on them, because it has made them be able to say anything goes. And now this man is laying down the criteria that anything doesn't go. Now this is a very important important thing, as a matter of fact, because you're faced here with two views, let's say, of quantum, something like that. So you can have, you have quantum in light, and I'm assuming that you know what the quantum theory is. It's that at one time they thought of light as being only particles. It used to be called corpuscles, something like this, of light. And then they found that certain experiments showed that light had to be a wave. And so you had two sets of experiments concerning light. One is that here light made up of particles, and then the opposite idea, light made up of waves. And how's it going to be both at the same time? And they just leaped over this by setting forth a quantum theory. The quantum theory, therefore, being that though these are contradictory, you state light to be both, depending on the experiments you're performing. Now then, Max Planck carried this into the material universe. And you will remember, I've quoted this before, Oppenheimer has said that Max Planck had a certain philosophy that made him able to accept this, a random relativistic philosophy. I've always pointed out, I don't know if this is true did I say Max Planck? It's all wrong. Niels Bohr, sorry. Everywhere that I said Max Planck in this immediate area, it's Niels Bohr. Oppenheimer said that Niels Bohr had a philosophy of relativistic thinking and so forth that enabled him to accept quantum in a deeper sense than merely light. In other words, his philosophy prepared him for this. Now, as I've pointed out many, many times, I'm not sure Oppenheimer's right on this. I don't know enough about Niels Bohr. But Oppenheimer did know Niels Bohr personally, and so maybe he's right. But whether he's right or not, you see, you're immediately confronted with this question. Whether Niels Bohr had the philosophy first of relativism and randomness, or whether he didn't, the real question is, how do you look at quantum when you begin to think of truth? And immediately you have two possibilities in the area of science. The first possibility being that you say, well, here are two things that express light, let's say, or further along in quantum, and they're irreconcilable, and therefore the universe is made up of an irrational element. This is one way you can look at this. The other way to look at it is quite contrary, and that is that though at the moment we can't bring the two together, we assume that there is a unity behind these two elements, which one day we will find. And the only thing we do in this case is like an army sweeping up through a plain and coming to a stronghold, and rather than wasting 20 years trying to take it, they merely sweep around to take the whole country and then later expect to be able to take the city. Now, actually, these are the two views of quantum that must be kept very clearly in mind. And if you think of Salvador Dali, for example, saying that he has become religious on the basis of the dematerialization of the material universe which modern science has indicated. This is a view, this would be in the direction, and you can think of many other examples, where you just assume that there's no real truth in the universe. The other possibility, as I say, is that you really expect to find a unity, and the only thing is you don't waste forever trying to solve the unity of this diversity at the moment. But you say both of these things explain it, or explain it in two different phases. I'm sure there's a unity. I'm sure there's a reasonableness in all this. But nevertheless, for the moment, we can operate on one or the other, depending on what is most practical at this given moment in my experiment. But these two concepts have to be kept entirely separate. If you take quantum to be the first, that you have a really irreconcilable situation in the universe, if you have this, it seems to support the modern views of philosophy, the random views of philosophy, for example, the irrationality concept of the universe, and would seem to support, in a certain direction, certain modern theology. But the real question is this the way to take it? Now, there are certain scientists, young scientists, that you run into who do think this way. This young man I ran into in Sussex University, who's an instructor in Sussex University, and a couple years ago. And when I deliberately used the word truth, feeling that this would sort of get a good conversation going with him, he immediately spoke up and said, "We don't use the word truth today. We just say that we make that this is a valid description, or it looks like this at the moment, something like this." But I pointed out to him, some of you have heard me tell this before, I pointed out to him a dilemma in his own position. And that is, I used at the time, they had just discovered a big superstar. And in the superstar, I had been reading of the fact that if their measurements were right, either the redshift theory was right or Einstein's was wrong, or Einstein's theory of relativity. I think I remember correctly. It's not my field. But I think I remember correctly. They said, if their measurements are right, you had to choose. So I asked him, well, isn't it so that you're not really making these theories in mid-air? Rather than making them in mid-air, where they touch that which is measurable, they must correspond or you give them up. And he agreed this was the case. And I said, well, I don't care if you call this truth or whatever you call it. That's what I mean by truth. And that is, there are certain things that you can deal with which are testable. And you're not just making up theories at random in a universe, and they can take any form you wish them to take, but rather at the point where they touch that which is measurable and full of judgment, that they have to conform or you let it go. Now, actually, that's what this man is saying. This man, in that opening paragraph, which I said was remarkable, what he was pointing out is that scientific theory must agree with the facts. Now, you can put forth any kind of a theory you want, but when it cuts down into the facts, that which touches that which is measurable, which is open to judgment, it must conform or you give up the theory and you look for another. So here now, this man, and I think it's right, this is the way science works. It works. It really doesn't work on the basis that there is no such thing as truth. It doesn't really work on the basis that you can make up any kind of a theory you want. For instance, Hoyle has been quoted as saying that he makes up maybe six new theories every morning before breakfast. Well, this is fun because it means here's a clever mind, he's got a sharp mind, and he just does this for his own gamemanship. But when it comes down into real discussion, he can't say, I hold these six different theories, contrary one to the other, in cosmology, something like this, the beginning of things, and it doesn't matter. It matters a great deal. So, for example, when they have really proved something about the universe, in these far-out forms of astronomy, as they have recently, and proved Hoyle's wrong. He has shifted his theory in order to conform with the place where it touches that which is observable. In other words, scientific theory really isn't a random philosophy. It is bounded by a certain thing. It is bounded by the form of the external universe where it is open to measure and to comprehension. So now, therefore, the first thing to say is that any drawing on the concept of quantum in order to support a modern anti-philosophy today, or a philosophy of irrationality, simply won't go. It won't go because that isn't the way science works. Science puts forth any kind of a theory, and the remarkable thing is that as you go deeper into the universe, what you come to is not greater and greater chaos, but what you come to is greater and greater order and greater unity. The second thing to say about this is that the young scientist who says that they don't really speak about truth, but only whether it's a good description, he doesn't really mean this. Because in every case, in his actual scientific work, when he is performing an experiment, if you can show him that his theory doesn't conform to the external phenomenon, the external world, he would invariably shift his theory in order to conform. This makes it impossible to begin to say that relativistic philosophies can draw support from modern science. It just simply isn't the case. It isn't the way things are going. Now this man carries on, however. Let me point out here, he says it isn't true that anything goes. It just isn't true. It's a little bit interesting to me that he says that he parallels this to the success of Impressionism on art critics. I think this indicates he knows more about science than he does about art. Because it wouldn't be Impressionism, it would be the post-Impressionists here that would lead men to be able to say, well, anything goes. Certain forms of post-Impressionism. The Impressionists, of course, were classical in their concepts of art. Or you can say they were, as I would say in my philosophic lectures, they were the doorway into Under the Line of Despair. But they themselves weren't caught up in this. But it is true, of course, that certain people would say this in our modern fields of art, that in the post-Impressionism and so on, that anything goes. Well, in that, I think he's made a good parallel, though maybe he's put it at the wrong place, it seems to me. It's a very interesting thing, anyway, that he draws these two together here. Something very close to the thing I would have done by where I began this lecture and then carrying it on specifically into the field of science. Now I'll skip one rather technical paragraph. And then the last paragraph of this section, Two Revolutions, runs on like this. The last paragraph of this section, Two Revolutions, the subheading, runs on like this. The old theory may have been refuted by its clash with some new facts. Its more successful replacement is found to have inherited some well-confirmed parts of the low-level structure of the old theory, possibly in a new guise. The new theory will, if successful, have a larger, well-conformed proportion, which will in turn be handed on when the new theory fails. Thus, there seems to be some steady building up, not just a continuously changing fashion. In other words, there is progress in science towards something that might be called truth. End of this section. Very exciting, coming from a modern philosopher in science. In other words, if you take an old law, let's say the Newton's physics, and then you put forth a new concept to take its place, actually what you're doing is not throwing everything overboard and starting again, but your new law must explain what the old law explained plus some new things. In other words, what you have is a wider area of unity. So if you would have, if I had a blackboard here, let's say I made five big white dots on the blackboard, meaning the particulars at hand, And the old theory would cover three of these, and then there'd be two points unexplained by the old theory. Then the new unity would have to explain all five. So you would accept the new, more sophisticated unity, or law, because that's all law is. A law is unity of diversity, giving an answer to diversity. covering certain points of diversity. So the new law, the new diversity, would be accepted if it covered all 5 points instead of merely 3. But that doesn't mean that the old law is completely pitched out. Because, after all, the new law has to explain everything the old law explained, plus 2 extra. Do you understand what I'm saying? So you're constantly moving to greater unities. Greater and greater unities, wherein the unity must cover more points of the particular. And that's the only reason you give up an old scientific law for a new one. The only reason you do it is in order that you would explain the particulars better. So you're constantly moving in science, not because you just sit these things and dream it up, as I say, like Hoyle, thinking up 6 or 8 new theories before breakfast every morning, but you think them up and then you bring them into relationship with the particulars in a certain field in the universe. And as you do, where it touches that which is open to demonstration and open to measure, it must fit, or you pitch it out. And then the new law is always taking you not towards chance, and not towards chaos, but always greater and greater unity of simplicity, covering more and more particulars. Now, this is the way all science has advanced. So if you find a law that would cover 2 points, and then there's 4 in the phenomena before you, then the thing you seek for is a law which would cover all 4. So constantly, science is moving toward not chaos, but unity. And not on the basis of people's just pipe dreaming, but of the structure of the universe itself. And this begins to get exciting. Because suddenly what you're confronted with is an external form of the universe which leads you away from chaos, always toward greater unities. And scientific theory, if it's real scientific theory, is not just a pipe dream, as I say. It's the structure of the universe, the external form of the universe itself, that leads you always toward greater and greater unity rather than greater and greater chaos, with more and more of the particulars simply explained. So in other words, if you have an old law and it's very, very complicated, what you do is get rid of it if you can find a simpler explanation of the particulars. But what you must do is to explain all the particulars of the phenomena under study. Now to go on. The next section is called, in the subheading, Noticing the Cracks. Now by cracks he means noticing where the old theory doesn't conform to what is measurable and observable in the external universe. And I'm just going to read. Many people may accept this view without appreciating some of its consequences. For instance, in heuristics, the study of discovery in science. It means that there is some logic of scientific discovery, for our search for new, better theories will be guided by the necessity to preserve well-confirmed, low-level parts of the old theory within a certain range of validity. The new theory, which will differ from the old in its higher levels, yet has to explain why the old theory worked. It will incorporate some low-level structure of the old theory wholesale, at least in certain approximations. This requirement, called the correspondence principle, if you're taking notes, it's worth noticing, between the new and the old theory constitutes a severe restriction on the choice of new theories. Any worker in scientific theories knows some parts which have to be preserved, but there is another heuristic guide. The best workers are those who are best at noticing cracks, anomalies, in the existing structure of the old theory. Not disagreements with the new experimental data, but anomalies within the theory itself. These cracks are very strong hints that suggest the structure of the new theory. We infer, as it were, the nature of the new three-dimensional beast from its two-dimensional footprints. They are traces of the new theory in the old. Now again, this is a very exciting thing, if you understand what he's saying. What he's saying, if you have a scientific theory, and you read it over, and it doesn't explain some things. He calls this a crack. So if you find a crack in the old theory, you know that the new theory has to be in the direction of explaining the crack. Do you see? If you've got a theory, and it explains, I have my 5 dots again, as particulars, and the old theory explains 3, you know that the new unity, including the old, will have to be in the direction of what explains the extra 2. It won't be in the opposite direction. In other words, it's not a random choice.
So your choice is always laid out ahead of you. You're forced to in a certain direction. So if you examine a scientific theory and it doesn't explain a certain portion of the phenomena, it immediately directs you in what direction you should look for a better answer. Now to go on still further. Read next paragraph. This is the paragraph that immediately follows. Pardon me. So the statement that all one can say about the process of scientific discovery is that it is a trial and error process is false. Do you understand what he's saying now? I've quit reading. I'm talking. He's saying it isn't just trial and error. There's already a line laid out for you that shows you what direction you have to go in. You aren't just shooting dice. But if you got these 2 points left over out of the five, you know that the unity has to be in that direction. It won't be in the opposite direction because these are the two that have to be explained, something like this. Now I'll read on further. The research worker is not just the proverbial rat in a maze banging its head against one another, one after another, of an infinite number of trapdoors. He has some insight, and incidentally, so I presume, has an actual rat. Now to go on. Let us try to be a little more specific. Consider the case frequently quoted as the example of scientific revolution, Einstein's special theory of relativity. Before 1905, classical physics consisted of two parts, Newtonian mechanics and Maxwell's theory of electromagnetism. It was obviously desirable to unify the two parts into one physics. Most people backed the Newtonian mechanics to be the fundamental theory. But all attempts to reduce Maxwell's theory of electromagnetism to Newton's mechanics failed. Closer inspection of the two theories reveals an anomaly that ensures that all such attempts were bound to fail. Classical physics had a flaw or crack down the middle. Then he goes on, he gives a long technical explanation of this, which wouldn't particularly bear on this. But what you're saying is here, now notice his example. Here's Einstein coming on. And as he says, this is usually quoted as the, and he puts the in italics, example of scientific revolution. What was your situation before this? You had the old Newtonian mathematics, and then you had Maxwell's theory of electromagnetism. So you have electromagnetism, you have the theory of mechanics, and the question is, what are you going to say about these that will give you a unity? Well, he says, as you examine it, the question is, which direction are you going to have to move in? Where are the particles unexplained? We have to look at the crack. And the crack wasn't in the direction of Maxwell's electromagnetism, but if you examine it carefully, it was rather in the fact that certain things in Newton's mechanics didn't answer the question. So you know that which side it had to move on. You weren't left like a rat just bumping its head on numerous doors. Do you see what he's saying? He's saying if you take a rat and you think of the rat always banging his head on doors, and he can move in any direction, though he raises a question about this too quite properly. But he says it isn't like that anyway, because the line already was laid out, because the crack was in the Newtonian mathematics, Newtonian mechanics, and not rather in Maxwell's electromagnetism. So you already knew what direction good science had to go. Good science had to go toward explaining this crack, and not in the opposite direction. Now, down at the, a little further in this same section, remember the subheading is noticing the cracks. This is an example of the general correspondence between new and old theories, but the example as a whole is intended to show how far we can be guided by inspection of an old theory in the building of a new, larger, better theory. Future theories cast their shadows before them. Indeed, in many cases, the new, larger theory incorporates the old theory as a whole undamaged. So he says now, notice what I'm using this as an example for. I'm using an example to show that how you know which way to move. You know which way to move by looking at the place where there's a crack in the old theory. And then you know, in order to answer the particulars better or more particulars, the answer will be in that direction and not the opposite direction. Is everybody with me? All right, because it sounds simple. Incidentally, it's spelled right beautifully for a scientist and giving a report, I must say. It's literature, too. Now, the next heading, and this isn't long, I'll say for those of you who are listening on tapes, and therefore you won't be able to check this article,
It is just the two pages of the listener. Most of you know what the listener looks like. So it's constituted, the whole article is constituted of only four solid columns. The listener is drawn up, you know, with two columns of type on each page. So there's two pages and four columns, just that long. So that will make you realize that I'm reading an appreciable amount of the article. The next subheading is No Blind Alley Theories. And this is the last paragraph of that under that subheading. From the point of view of present-day philosophy, the fact that there is continuous progress in science is a problem, while the fact there are occasional revolutions is not. This fellow really knows his business. Because, after all, what he's talking about in modern philosophy is always an anti-philosophy. Just, this is the terminology I would choose. So, therefore, it is in the direction of a random situation. So you have continental existentialism and the situation is absurd. Well, if it's absurd, why does science always lead you toward progress? Why does it always lead you toward unity instead of chaos? Do you see what he's saying? Or if you take current Anglo-Saxon philosophy, the defining philosophy, these have given up all hope of any unity in the foreseeable future. And all they're doing is spending endless time defining certain categories in limited areas. And I was very impressed with that in my trip I've just come back to from Britain, and being able to talk to some of these instructors. That's all their philosophy consists of, is endless discussion about relatively small areas of categories and never putting forth any concept of philosophy as philosophy that would have always dominated the largest sphere of philosophy prior to Immanuel Kant. So before Immanuel Kant, you would always have a certain amount of discussion about categories, that probably they wouldn't have called them categories, and small details. But the end of the whole, the big thing of philosophy, was always the thought that you could put forth, as I've described it often in my lectures, a circle that would encompass all of knowledge and you could live with it. In other words, you could run a series of experiments on it and prove it, though nobody ever did in their rationalistic philosophy. Modern philosophy is exactly opposite. In the existential philosophy, everything is counted as absurd before you start. In the modern, defining, linguistic Anglo-Saxon philosophy, I'll say in parenthesis in contrast to Heidegger's linguistics, just to make it clear to anyone who knows Heidegger, but in the Anglo-Saxon linguistic defining philosophy, they don't put forth any circle at all. All they do is spend all their time in what was considered the minor section of philosophy prior to Immanuel Kant. And they never get around to what men would have always thought was the primary purpose of making your definitions, and that is coming and putting forth a theory and claiming that this would contain knowledge. In other words, give you a purpose, let's say, meaningfulness in a unified field. So you have two kinds of anti-philosophy today. You could say you have others, and not everything's anti-philosophy, but all the major streams are anti-philosophy today. You have the existentialist, who already says everything's absurd, and then you have the Anglo-Saxon defining philosophers that don't say it's absurd, but they just say this is all we can know. We can only make certain small definitions, and this is where we are. Well, now, he quite properly points out that with this kind of a philosophic mentality, they must be taken by surprise that when you follow the external order of the universe, rather than ever moving toward chaos, you always move toward greater unities. It is very exciting. I mean, it's time to run the flag up on the flagpole at this particular point, because this is really exciting. That the external form of the universe, in the area, now I'm not talking about science, I'm not talking about philosophy, I'm not talking about art and the problem with communication in art, but those of you who've heard my lectures in these, you should be building bridges across here, because these are really together. But I'm talking just about straight science. So the curious thing is that here you have the modern philosopher, and as far as he's concerned, he's always taken by surprise that when you come into the external form of the universe, instead of going toward chaos, that science is always going toward greater unity in the explanations of more and more particulars under great headings of unity. In other words, just very simply, isn't it strange that with philosophy saying we live in a day of absurdity, yet nevertheless science is showing that the external form of the universe makes sense? It's very curious as you think about this tension. So what is good science? Good science has been demonstrated not because men have said it should, but because they have found it has. Good science is proving that the universe is moves toward always a greater and greater explanation of more and more particulars under the heading of more and more simple and encompassing unities. I've been saying all that, and I'll start back again to begin this, read this paragraph to give you the full feel of it. From the point of view of present-day philosophy, the fact that there is continuous progress in science is a problem, while the fact that there are occasional revolutions is not. There is no logical reason why a scientific theory should not be replaced by a theory different from the old at every level. But this is not what has happened so far. The most radical revolutions have destroyed the top levels and given a somewhat different interpretation of the lower levels, but they have not destroyed the whole of the lower level structure. The internal connections, the pattern, is preserved. The periodic system is the basis of inorganic chemistry. This pattern was not changed when the whole of chemistry was reduced to physics. Nor do science ever expect to see an explanation in the realm of chemistry which destroys that pattern. The chemical atom is no longer strictly an atom. Yet, whatever revolutions may occur in fundamental particle physics, the ordering of chemical atoms will remain. That's a tremendous idea. In other words, where he says there's no logical reason why it should be this way. What does he mean, there's no logical reason? Well, he means that in the area of being, if you begin with the modern man's concept of the impersonal plus time plus chance being all there is, it's an amazing thing if you find that the orders always stand. In other words, somebody like Einstein should have been able to make a theory that said everything previous to this was total junk. Just total junk. Everything was wrong. But he's pointing out, isn't it funny? It never happens that way. What you always have is a building like a pyramid. You never deny the lower structure when you go to the next, but you find perfect order in the whole. Not because, mind you, that the philosopher says you should, because the modern philosopher is taken by surprise. Not because, on the basis of what he calls a logical... What does he say? Let me get my glasses back on here. There is no logical reason. What does he mean? Well, he means in the area of rationalism, that is only beginning from man outward, there is no logical reason on the basis of rationalism that you would find as an explanation to this phenomena, which now is universally accepted. Well, this begins to ring a little bell, because on the basis of his own viewpoint of science, if it is true that rationalism gives us no logical reason for this stupendous thing that you find, maybe rationalism's wrong. I mean, this is suddenly, surely, where we come. Suddenly we come to the factor, well, are you right? If you say here's this total structure and it always leads you this way, even if your philosophy isn't, it wouldn't be conducive to it. The very external structure of it. Now come to think of your five dots, you see. If you have five dots and your theory, your universal of rationalism, only covers two and it leaves a three or 3,000 untouched, as it were, Wouldn't your own system by which you say science grows put forth a concept that you're moving in the wrong direction? In other words, he's already said you can't make up any theory you want to. You can't do this at all for the simple reason it has to conform to the facts, that which is measurable. So in other words, no matter how fancy your theory could be, something as far out as the new astronomy, for example, at the place where it cuts across what is measurable, it must measure up, or you ditch it and you start with something new. You are not free, remember he said this in the beginning, to make any kind of a theory you want. It must be a theory that stands up in contact with the external form of the universe that you yourself find, that science finds. You're not free to choose anything. You have to move in this direction. And then, interestingly enough, you have this piling up. Well, then, certainly you would raise a question here. If rationalism gives you no reasonable reason for this, and yet all science proves to be moving in this direction up to this time, doesn't it raise a question as to whether, really, this isn't, to not use his own terminology, isn't this where the crack's appearing in the old theory? Because what he says is, you look for the crack where it doesn't measure up. Where it doesn't measure up, you know then the crack shows you what direction you're going to have to move to the next step, because you know what isn't explained. Well, if there's no reason to all this, and isn't this a major crack?
on the basis of rationalism, on the basis of man merely starting from himself? Wouldn't it begin to indicate on his own basis of the theory of science and its progress that the answer would be an opposite direction than that which would lead the philosophers and lead the scientists, the naturalistic scientists, to be taken by surprise? Now, you have, remember my topic. I said I wasn't sure if it was a good title, but I guess it is as I go along. Naturalistic science is poor science. In other words, yeah, that'll do. Naturalistic science is poor science. So in other words, on the basis of his own, remember he's a philosopher of science. On the basis of his own philosophy of science, here I would say is a major crack, and if a man wasn't so set in his own presuppositions, his own naturalistic presuppositions, that he couldn't see above them, it would seem to me that immediately, not on the basis even of philosophy, nor on the basis of religion, commonly thought of, but merely on the basis of science, it would raise the question, isn't my direction poor science? Now let's go on a bit further. The next subheading is New Monarch, Old Functions. Skip one paragraph and then this. The emperors of science, the super laws, have repeatedly been replaced in the history of science. Brackets. I certainly expect quantum mechanics to suffer this fate. End of brackets. Yet I believe that science is progressing toward a unique truth. Toward a unique truth. What unique truth? Merely a unique truth based on what you find in the universe as it is, leading you toward ever more appreciable universals. Contrary to all naturalistic philosophy's conclusions, that why should it be this way? Never mind why it should be this way. Isn't it funny? That's the way it is. This is the way it is. I'm intrigued by this little parenthesis here. I certainly expect quantum mechanics to suffer this fate. In other words, what he's saying there, remember I gave a little parenthesis on quantum back half hour ago, or three quarters of an hour ago now, he's saying that I really expect it to turn out this way, that we're going to find an answer to the two halves of quantum. This is what he's saying. This is what I think. I don't think it's going to remain always like this, but sometime we're going to find a universal that covers both sides of the quantum presentation. But never mind that. Just interesting. Now, there are just two more paragraphs in the article. And this is the last paragraph under New Monarch, Old Functions. It continues from exactly where I stopped reading. There is at least one profound difference between biological evolution and the evolution of scientific theory, : a biological line may develop along any of a vast number of divergent paths. He has divergent in italics. The path taken depends in part on external influences, and development may indeed be reversed under certain changes of external conditions. Scientific theory, on the other hand, converges, and he has this in italics, toward a unique truth. This progress is only helped by external influences, however one-sided, such as scientific fashions and prejudices of individual scientists. Now, never mind what he says about evolution. Just notice what he's drawing here. He says that biological evolution could go in any way, almost any way you can think of. Now, we might have questions at this particular point, but that doesn't matter for tonight. He's just making a point, and let's just accept it without accepting it, if you know what I mean. So that he's saying here is a contrast. The contrast is the biological evolution is random. This is really his direction. The biological, especially for people with a tape. I'm not saying I accept this. I'm just accepting it as his illustration. He says here is something that is totally random. But in contrast, the evolution of scientific theory is exactly opposite. Instead of it being random out over the full 360-degree circle, in any direction you can imagine and moving almost without any common sense, it would seem, instead of that, the evolution of scientific theory, in other words, the growth of scientific theory, that's all the word evolution would mean here, the growth of scientific theory, rather than this, converges ever toward a more and more sharp perspective. So he says, in contrast to this, which is totally random from his viewpoint, here the curious thing is, as you begin back and begin with, say, Galileo or Leonardo da Vinci, and you come along through modern science, wherever you want to start, back there somewhere, and you come along through modern science as you do this, the curious thing is, rather than it proving to be random, always you're moving from more and more diverse situations, a wider base of particulars, to a more and more simple unity. And he's absolutely right. And, of course, the big illustration is Einstein, who has brought, now he's going to quote Einstein, but I'll just use it here, who has brought all the material universe down into two unities, electromagnetism and gravity. So, as far as the material universe is concerned, Einstein has said, and almost everybody's accepted today, that you only now have two unities that cover all the possible particulars in the material world. So instead of moving out, as he would claim evolution did, into more and more diverse forms randomly, science has proven that as you go deep into the material universe, you move in the direction of greater and greater unity, covering more and more of the particulars. So you're always going toward unity in contrast to diversity. Do you understand what I'm saying? So his concept of biological evolution is that you're always becoming more diversified. Again, I say, never mind what we think of this. It's a good illustration, just on face value here. But the change in scientific theory always moves in the opposite direction, from a greater diversity to greater unity. The deeper we go into the universe, the more the unity covers more of the particulars. Now we're to the last paragraph, and this is the called Nature's Well-Formulated Puzzle. And it's just one paragraph long. And it's almost all a quote from Einstein. But let me go back to this convergence again before I read this. In other words, modern philosophy is anti-philosophy. Modern philosophy has given up the concept of unity. Instead of that, modern philosophy says all is absurd. Or you have the defining philosophers who say we can't find any of it. So modern philosophy has ceased to be philosophy. But the curious thing is, modern science has proven to be moving in the direction of unity. So philosophy no longer gives unity, but science proves increased unity. So curiously enough, science is in the position where philosophy used to be, but with one titanic exception, and that is, there's no place for man. And here would be my wage. In other words, philosophy has given up the dream of unity. But science is finding increased unity. But as it finds its increased unity, it explains more and more of the particulars, except one set of particulars, and that is the particular of man. Now I'm talking about naturalistic science. Science built on a closed system of the uniformity of cause and effect. So, dealing with a material universe, using material now, not naively, realizing that we're now the place where you end up with energy rather than mass, but nevertheless, material universe will do. In the material universe, using a uniform field of the uniformity of cause and effect, you are moving in the exact opposite direction than the modern philosophers. You're moving in the direction of increased unity, and that's what you want to do. Science wants to find the unity which gives the explanation for all the particulars. Now, therefore, Thinking, of Einstein as coming up with an answer of electromagnetism and gravity in covering all the particles, or all the particulars, rather, you find, therefore, that instead of millions of particulars, you only have two. And you've moved toward a titanic step of unity. But notice that Einstein's theory of electromagnetism and gravity leaves one particular unexplained. And that particular is man. And personality. Now, the tricky part of this is then on the basis of this whole article, one would expect that we could find a further unity, a higher law, a new super law, as he's called them, that would explain what the old law explains, and yet explain also this one factor that the old thing doesn't explain, and that is man. So what he said, you see, is that you don't deny the old laws when you make the new one. The wonderful thing about science is that you find you keep the old laws, but incorporate it in the new. And the new explains the old, plus the particulars that weren't explained in the old. So modern science has come down to the place wherein we have almost unity, electromagnetism and gravity, explaining the material universe, but one great particular is left unexplained, that particular that's left unexplained is man. So following that which he says has been the history of science, one would find the next super law, the next universal, the next great truth, to be able to cover what the old law covers so perfectly, namely the uniformity of cause and effect, but equally would explain man. That's what he says we would expect. Well, how would you get it done? He's also said that you can examine the old law to find the cracks in it, to find which direction you would expect the new explanation to come. Well, what is it that the science is not explaining? Science is not explaining personality. Isn't this a crack? Seems to me it's a titanic one. Seems to me that everything he said, that we would expect the blowout of the old system that would point in the direction of the real explanation of all the particulars, including man and personality, we would find it in this direction, on this side, because this is that which the old law simply does not explain. So on the basis of all he said, it seems to me that if I were a really neutral scientist, what I would be expecting would be a new super law that would hold the truth of the explanation of that's given by the old laws, namely a uniformity of cause and effect in certain areas, and yet nevertheless, which would now increase the width of the triangle from a unity greater still to encompass this one particular that's still unexplained by modern science, and that is man. Now the last paragraph, nature's well-formulated puzzle. This is an astounding paragraph, and I'll read the whole thing just cold. As the arch-revolutionary Einstein says, colon, quote. Now, the rest of this paragraph, to the end of it, is made up of a series of quotes from Einstein. The historical development has shown that among the imaginable theoretical constructions, there is invariably one that proves to be unquestionably superior to all others. Nobody who really goes into the matter will deny that the world of perceptions determines the theoretical system in a virtually unambiguous manner. A man engaged in solving a well-designed word puzzle may, it is true, propose any word as a solution, but there is only one word which really solves the puzzle in all its forms. It is an outcome of faith that nature takes the character of such a well-formulated puzzle. The successes reaped up to now by science do, it is true, give a certain encouragement for this faith, period, end of quote. That's the most fantastic paragraph you could ever get together. Here's Einstein himself, the man who's quoted by somebody like Salvador Dali as saying, well, it gives us a concept of relativity. No, it doesn't at all. Einstein is saying, isn't it funny? It isn't relative at all. It's exactly opposite. He says it's just like a crossword puzzle. If you have a crossword puzzle, and here you have a six-letter word equaling umpty-dump-dum. And he says, well, you can put any word in there, but when you check all the cross words, you suddenly realize you can put forth 100 suggestions, but only one word fits all the factors. In other words, you're working in a testable situation, and when you're getting down and you finish all the tests, you don't have six possible words, you only have one possible word, and the more tests you run on the crosswords in the crossword puzzle, the more it's obvious which word it is in contrast to all the other. It's absolutely unambiguous. Now, Einstein says, isn't it funny? That's the way the universe is. The deeper you go into the universe, the more unambiguous it is. In other words, the deeper you go into the universe, the less relative it is, the more absolute it is. And, of course, that's Einstein's whole position. Anybody who quotes Einstein as king of relativists really doesn't understand Einstein at all, because Einstein's the least relative man that we've had in science forever. He has the very opposite idea that Oppenheimer said Niels Bohr had. I'm not saying that was Niels Bohr's position, but it certainly was the exact opposite than what Oppenheimer seems to say that Niels Bohr had. And that, as Einstein found, even though he's an atheistic Jew and given up his Judaistic belief, yet nevertheless he found, rather than being led deeper into a random situation, which many atheistic Jewish philosophers have taken, he found that the form of the universe led him in exactly the opposite direction. That the more you learned about the universe, the less ambiguous it is. So, of course, he has you can see this in two ways. So in his theory of relativity, you have a constant speed of light in a vacuum, which the whole thing is built on a non-relative base. On the other hand, you have the fact that he can move down into the whole area of the external universe and say, isn't it strange? We come up with just a double answer, electromagnetism and gravity. And he had every expectation that somebody was going to find the capstone above these two. In other words, the universe, instead of leading toward randomness, a chance, leads to always, the deeper you go into it, it leads to an increased order. Now, he says, as you run this experiment, the deeper you go, Einstein says, the more it indicates that which our faith would say. And that is that our faith as scientists is that this is so. And the more experiments you run, the more you prove the faith is valid. Now, as I've said so many times, Einstein became a mystic at the end of his life. He didn't come back to Judaism. He didn't become a Christian. He just took a mysticism with nothing there, in a sense.
A mystic, a modern mystic. A mystic not with the God of the Jews there, but a mystic without any certainty that anything was there, and yet a kind of a mysticism that gave him a faith that, after all, this is the way the universe is, and science goes this way, and all science goes this way. Science would die... whatever time it is, science would be dead 30 seconds from now if men gave up the concept that you can move from the particulars to the universal. Science would be finished. Curious thing is, all scientists act on the faith that that's the way it is. Otherwise, you would never have science. Men wouldn't give their lives if they kept coming to a random situation almost. It's just as I've said many times, you can make a new French movie, and you can take a man's life and then shuffle the frames, and you can show it. And everybody goes and looks once, maybe, because I think this is a funny kind of a picture, and it's interesting, and makes a philosophic statement that this is all there is to life. But if every cinema was only a shuffling of the frames, nobody would go, because it becomes stupid. Why go to see six? They would all be the same. It's just a chance situation. And so it is with scientists. Scientists would quit their experimentation if it hadn't been proven that you could move always to greater unities from the particular. If they found chance, just think, if starting tomorrow morning they began to find chance in the whole circumference of experimentation, I mean, you quit. What's the use? What in the world would be the use? There wouldn't be any. So Einstein says, it's funny, that's the way it goes. And then, as I say, he became a mystic at the end of his life in order to maintain this. And that the deeper you go, the interesting thing is, the more it is obvious, the more checks you can run. It's very contrary to this young scientist from the Sussex University, this young instructor that said to me several years ago, we don't use the word truth, we just use the word this is a good description, or it's valid for this given moment. This man is pointing out, that's poor science. That really isn't the way it goes. What we go is that the more we do, more we discover, the more we find, instead of that, we can say this is true, because you're moving always toward a certain unity. It isn't a random unity. You don't have any choices, really, because the old theories blow out on one side. You know the direction which to move, and then you have to run a series of tests, as Einstein says so beautifully, like a crossword puzzle, and then you know which word is right. And you don't have, finally, a half a dozen ways. You have a way, finally. And then science says, oh, yes, that's right. That's right. Now, finishing the lecture, I finished reading this article. That was the end of it, and it just says third program. It was given on the third program of BBC. Now, let's go on with my lecture, with that as a word in the middle of it. How did modern science begin? Well, Einstein says, isn't it funny? This is a theory this is a faith we work on, and that it proves to be right, that there's going to be an order in the universe and not randomness. But let us notice that only Christianity has ever produced a science. Only Christianity has ever produced a science. And this isn't just Christians who say this, but as so many times I've pointed out, a man like Oppenheimer says it. Oppenheimer says very clearly, and I think most scientists would agree, that before the birth of modern science, say the Greeks had almost as much knowledge as we had, as much raw material, and yet they never produced a science. And the East never produced a science. Well, how is it the East never produced a science and the Greeks didn't produce a science as we call it science? It's very easy. And it falls into two halves. Why Christianity was the needed component part in order to produce the science. In the first place, the first half was that on the basis of the Judaistic-Christian tradition, the external universe is real. And this is tremendous. If you think of Jean-Paul Sartre asking the question, he says, the only real question there is why there's something instead of nothing.
That's Jean-Paul Sartre's final question. That's a good question. Not only why is there order in it, but why is it there at all? In other words, this question being with a capital B. Why is there anything there? Now, the opposite direction is the eastern direction. That says, well, everything eventually is just a dream of God. So it's just an illusion. The curious thing is that a place like Bristol University, where I was a couple weeks ago, the real men who were willing to go through two nights down to the end of the road, at the second night, by about 2 o'clock in the morning, they really agreed that moving in the direction they were moving in, the only logical conclusion is that everything's an illusion. And these were the men who were playing the game out to the end. That they sat in what I would call the cocoon of themselves and had no certainty that anything existed outside of themselves, and hence the whole world was a world of illusion. And these are, I would say, the courageous men who play the game in the opposite direction from Christianity. Christianity, on the other hand, says everything isn't a dream of God, but God created the external universe out of nothing, and the external universe is outside of himself. This is my way of expressing, as you know, that the Bible teaches that the external universe is not an extension of the essence of God. It isn't an extension of his being, capital B. Rather, God really created it out of nothing with a true essence. From Christianity. Christianity, on the other hand, says everything isn't a dream of God, but God created the external universe out of nothing, and the external universe is outside of himself. This is my way of expressing, as you know, that the Bible teaches that the external universe is not an extension of the essence of God. It isn't an extension of his being, capital B. Rather, God really created it out of nothing with a true objective existence. So the first reason the West can have a science is because there's something there to run tests on. You can't run tests merely if it's all in a subjective area or in an area of illusion. The second reason the West produced a science was because the men who began modern science, Western science, all believed that there was a creator who was a reasonable God, and therefore it was reasonable to expect that we could find the order of the universe with our reason because he was a reasonable God. Now, these two points are the real reason that modern science has only come from Christianity. There's a real external world that exists, and secondly, because God is a reasonable God, therefore, it's not surprising that one can find on the basis of rationality and reason the order of the universe that he made. You would expect a reasonable God to create a reasonable external universe that you could proceed upon on the basis of your reasonableness or rationality. And this carries with it, of course, the concept of the uniformity of cause and effect. This carries with it the concept of the uniformity of cause and effect. Because this God, if he makes a reasonable universe and it is a real history and not just an illusion, you are not surprised to find that in this real universe that exists, created by a reasonable God, there would be order and there would be also a reasonable cause and effect, which you could trace on the basis of your own reason. And then always back into greater unity in the midst of the diversity. So let's understand, modern science was not born by people who had a blind leap of faith, like Einstein suggests. As a matter of fact, if men had had the modern philosophy's concepts, nobody would have started modern science. What I've said is a very deep thing, and please think what I've said. It's not just a passing sentence. If the men who had lived at the time of the birth of modern science had had the random concept, the absurd concept of the modern philosopher, they never would have started in the area of science. The reason they start in the area of science is simply because it was reasonable that it was going to be this way in the light of what they knew was so. That there is a God who has created things truly outside of himself, and that being a reasonable God, you could expect that he would create a reasonable universe, and you could operate, therefore, on the twin things of a uniformity of cause and effect on one hand and an expectation that you could move from particulars to unity on the other. Therefore, this was the base of modern science. And let me say again, this would not have been started, there'd been no reason to start it, if the men who lived then had been modern philosophers. Now, science, thinking of this article I've read, but thinking of just science in general, science is always moving in the direction of laws are universal to explain more particulars. If a law does not sufficiently explain what is being observed, we seek a new one. So if Newton's old law of mechanics didn't answer all the questions, all the reasonable questions about a certain set of phenomena, you simply look for a new law. And so Newton's mechanics have now been set aside for something else, one of the new laws. Now, as modern man has gone on, even though the first scientists really did understand, really did have a base for it, modern man doesn't have a base. And as modern man has gone on, he has operated more and more upon the a closed field of the uniformity of cause and effect. A closed field of the uniformity of cause and effect. In other words, it's the very opposite from the original scientists. Because the original scientists all were men who weren't surprised that the universe made sense because they began with another concept. A concept when they didn't have a unified field of mechanical cause and effect. They believed that there was somebody outside of the cause and effect who wasn't mechanical, and therefore it wasn't surprising that he would make a reasonable universe. So believing there was a God who wasn't caught in the mechanical sense of the uniformity of cause and effect, they could begin expecting the universe to be reasonable. Modern science, having become naturalistic or materialistic, atheistic or agnostic, however one to think of it, modern science has put everything there is now in the circle of the uniformity of cause and effect, a mechanical cause and effect, a unified field of cause and effect. And there's nothing outside of it. But the curious thing is, if they were right, science couldn't have begun in the first place. But secondly, if they're right, it doesn't explain the order they now find in the universe, even though they now don't have any real reason for knowing why it's there. Isn't this funny? You see what I'm beginning to say? The naturalistic science is really very poor science. It denies everything, really, that they function on. So therefore, they wouldn't have started in the first place, but secondly, by coming to the place where they now are, they have no explanation for the very order which they now find. So somebody like Einstein has to become a mystic in order just to have some intellectual integrity. But it's a mysticism without anybody there in a certain real sense, as far as anything you know. Certainly without any real content that would explain it in the way the original scientists had content to explain it. So they have come now to a mechanical view of the universe, which had not have started science in the first place, and which doesn't explain doesn't explain what they find of order. So we find them coming to a concept of faith in the case of Einstein. And specifically, it doesn't explain what man is. So it doesn't explain the order which they find. And this puts them especially in a bind because there's one particular that their view of the mechanical view of the universe doesn't explain at all. It really doesn't explain even the others why it's there, But there is one, it seems to me, that just kicks them in the shins at this point. If you're thinking of a series of 1 million particulars, run far higher, of course, but 1 million particulars, well, let's make it 1,000,001, then my mathematics won't have to be so difficult. 1,000,001 particulars, and 1,000,000 is explained by the uniformity of cause and effect. There's still one particular that stands outside of their pyramid to cover the whole, and that is man. So the curious thing is, the one thing man knows best, man himself, is not explained by their universal. Now, they wouldn't explain more than this. They wouldn't explain the whole reason for why there is order there. But forget that for a moment now. I've already said that a dozen times. Let me pass on. And there's one particular that just stands shouting. Now, supposing a man was running a scientific theory on a certain chemical composition in a test tube, and it had 10 properties, and his theory explained 9 properties, but there was one little property that every time he ran the experiment would shout, "Hey, you haven't explained me." And he kept running the experiment. He just kept saying, "But this is a sufficient universal. This is a sufficient universal. This is a sufficient universal." But he and his colleagues ran experiment 1,000 times, and each time this one little property out of the 10 would shout, "Hey, but what about me?" And pretty soon some scientists would say, "Listen, fella, this isn't a very good theory. Because if you're really going to explain, if you're really going to claim a universal, you have to explain this one little property that keeps shouting all the time, this one out in far left field, this one way out there in left field that keeps putting up its glove and shouting, 'I'm here too. What are you going to do about me?'" Now then, this is the dilemma of science. It leaves out one part of the phenomena, and that is man. And the curious thing is, this is the thing which man knows best. So the funny part is, it isn't just a funny little part of the phenomena out in left field, but the one thing that man knows best is not explained by their universal theory of the uniformity of cause and mechanical cause and effect. And this isn't just me, but it's man wherever you find him. Now, it's easy to talk like this today. No scientist would go after me. 15 years ago, they would have tried to gun you down at this particular point, because they'd say you're bringing in a subjective note because you're bringing in your own knowledge. But, of course, a number of years ago now, Oxford University exhibited that you can't run any kind of an experiment without you being the programmer. You arrange the experiment. So now, in all good science everywhere, it is uniformly accepted that you have to take in the observer. In other words, you never have an experiment without an observer. Because, after all, there's always a scientist who's looking at the end of the test tube. Something like this. You arrange the experiment, and you are the observer. So, consequently, today, what I'm saying is good science. And that is, you have to explain the thing which you yourself can observe, and the thing you yourself can observe best is yourself. And therefore, here is a phenomena. I've given a picture now of 1,000,000 pieces and then one unexplained. But you have a very different situation. You don't even have a situation of your baseball team and then just one man out in left field raising his glove and saying, "I'm here too." You have something far different. You have experiment of everybody who's living. So everybody that's living constitutes a phenomena that's unexplained by naturalistic science. But more than that, happily, because of our artifacts in art, we know that not only do we think that we are men, with these points that make us different from other things, but we know that wherever we find men, through the artifacts of art, where we have enough of them to make a judgment, they thought of themselves this way too. So the curious thing is, for example, that if you go back to the caves, you never find a cave wherein you have enough material in the wall paintings to really understand the culture. You never find a cave that doesn't have a shaman. And a shaman illustrates that these people didn't think they were machines. Shaman's the holy man. So what you have here is a funny little bug.
In other words, wherever you find a man today, you find somebody who really finds it very difficult, if not impossible, and I think impossible, to act as though he is a machine. Then you go back into the artifacts of art, and everywhere you find men, you find that these two also reflect the mannishness of man. So wherever you find a cave, wherever you find an artifact in art, just think, for example, the Renaissance art. These people are human people. You go back far beyond that, you come to the Romans, and you look at the Roman busts in a good museum in Italy, and you're overwhelmed. Now, these aren't strange people. They're the people you see on the street every day. And then the illustration I love best, you go all the way back to the caves. And as I've said in my last lecture tour when I was in the States, somebody showed me some reproductions from caves. And they showed me one. I knew most of them, but they showed me one which was brand new to me. And that is somebody a long, long time ago in one of the caves followed the fissure of the rock and carved the body of a woman. And she didn't have a head. But when you looked at her body, she could have been the woman next door. And she wasn't strange. You didn't say, "What is this thing?" You just said, "Oh, yes, there's a woman. There's a female part of the human race." And the curious thing is, these aren't strange people. These are people like ourselves. And as you get back, and as I say, you study the shaman, and you go back into other aspects, back as far as we can go in writing, to the Sumerians, way back beyond that, and these people are people, just like this. So it seems to me this is a very funny kind of a science now. It's a science that is erasing a universal, and they don't have any explanation for the order it's there. But secondly, they don't have any explanation for the one phenomena which we know best and which doesn't stand like the little man in left field or the first of a million and one, but it's millions and millions and millions and millions of people with whom we find correspondence when we study the artifacts in art. We find them all to be people. And all these people, in a way, are raising their voice, just like I said, the tenth property of that was unexplained in the chemical experiment would say, "Hey, I'm here. You don't cover me." Well, it seems to me that everywhere you begin to hear the voice of the people, and they begin to say, "Hey, you don't cover me, you don't cover me, you don't cover me, you don't cover me." Well, this is a very funny kind of science, I would suggest. I would just say, naturalistic science. Never mind about it being wrong from a Christian viewpoint. I would just charge that naturalistic science is extremely poor science, because it doesn't explain the phenomenon at hand. And the scientists themselves testify to this, because the scientists themselves don't live on the basis of the theories. They are always living in a dichotomy. This thing that I've given so many times of my friend, this young scientist, who was telling me a theory of the universe being the only energy particles. And I said to him, "But what about your colleagues? You're a Christian now." He'd become a Christian here. "You're a Christian here, so it's all right for you. But what about your colleagues?" And when they go home to their wife at night, he just said, "Well, Mr. Schaefer, these people live in a dichotomy." So in other words, when he comes out of his laboratory saying everything is explained on a unified field, of uniform mechanical field of cause and effect, and when he goes home to his wife and his children, he has to deny his own theory. So it isn't just other people are shouting, "Hey, you don't explain me," but the scientist himself doesn't explain himself when he acts as a man. Not a bit of it. So it isn't just the people in the caves, it isn't just the artifacts, it isn't everybody, just other people living, but the scientist himself cannot live on the basis of his own universal, which he claims is a sufficient explanation, and that is a purely mechanical situation. Because every scientist, when he falls in love, and when he loves his children, and makes certain moral judgments, now as a man, rather than the scientist, when he does these things, in reality, he is denying the sufficiency of his own universal. I'm just saying, naturalistic science is very poor science for the simple reason it doesn't explain what needs to be explained. And that is, what one needs a universal that would explain the uniformity of cause and effect in the mechanical universe and still explain man. Now notice I'm following exactly in the line that this H.R. Post went. I'm suggesting that if you were just progressing in the long line of science and you had an old theory like Newtonian mechanical concept, Newtonian mechanics, and it explained a lot of things, But there's some factors unexplained. When you make the new super law, you would have to explain, you'd have to do two things. You'd have to keep that which explains what the old law explained, plus now explaining what the old law didn't explain. So you have to keep explaining the uniformity of cause and effect in the mechanical part of the universe, and yet you would have to explain man. But you'd have to explain man without denying what science has found truly of what works under the law of cause and mechanical cause and effect in the material universe. So you wouldn't just find post now, this man's article, you wouldn't throw this out because this works. But on the other hand, you have to have an answer that explains what isn't included. So you have to find a universal, moving always toward what he calls this unique truth, a greater and greater universal. What you need is a universal now that would continue to explain the old, and yet at the same time explain the phenomena, namely man, which has not been explained, without denying this old. What does it? What would do this? I would just say, certainly it isn't in the direction of Einstein's leap of faith and this strange mysticism he drags in. This doesn't explain anything. This is an acknowledgement of defeat. It's not an explanation. You need an explanation that would continue to give a reasonableness as why the mechanical universe, the material universe, can be understood on the basis of the uniformity of cause and effect, and yet you would have to explain man. Now, following the scientific method, let us notice that if you don't explain, you look for a universal that will, yet not denying the old, which is involved here. Yet not denying the old, that is, in this case, not denying the fact that there is such a thing as an external universe that does exist and which functions on the laws of cause and effect and reasonableness, so you can proceed in them on the basis of reason. So you have to explain man, but you keep this. You have to keep this uniformity of cause and effect in the material world, but you need to explain this reoccurring phenomena, the thing which man knows best of man. What does it? Well, I would simply say the first scientists already knew the answer. It's a funny thing. The first scientists understood the answer. They had an answer which was adequate. An answer that began with a personal God, and consequently personality would not take them by surprise, where you found it outside of the uniformity of cause and effect. And yet, at the same time, a personal beginning, and yet at the same time, they weren't surprised that they found a uniformity of cause and effect in the universe and a reasonableness, because they thought this God was a reasonable God, so it would have made a reasonable universe. What's wrong with that universal? I'd say this is good science. Never mind about it being Christianity and good religion. It's just good science. It's just good science. And that's all. Because this would be a universal that would be sufficient. So you would have an external world which functions reasonably as on a mechanical basis with true cause and effect, but that there's something above it, something that's not caught in it, something that can work down into it, something that is not imprisoned in the law of cause and effect. Something, indeed, that explains why it's there and the order in the universe, and yet at the same time something that can cut across it, namely personality, whether it's in the personality of God, who can work into this cause and effect in real miracle when he wishes, as well as having started it. It's not a deistic God. Or whether it is the little man out in left field. And the little man out in left field, if somebody's paid him $100 to lose the ball game, and the ball comes out there, he can decide, I'm going to miss it. So the ball follows the natural laws of cause and effect and hits on the field, and the game's lost. But if he makes up his mind, I want to win the ball game and I'm not going to throw it, $100 or no $100, and he therefore starts to run, a non-deterministic system, and he catches the ball, he has interrupted the cause and effect. The funny part is, it just happens that this is good science because it is a universal that explains all the particulars. The particulars that are explained mechanically, in which the old laws then would explain, but an addition of a new law, a new universal,
a super law, as he's called it here, if you want to think of it. Now I'm thinking from the scientific side, which would explain the phenomena that was not explained by the old line. And following his concept of cracks, showing the way it has to move, this is not surprising, because the crack in the modern mechanical viewpoint is in the direction of personality, because this is the thing, it's not explained, so one would not be surprised if this is then blazes the way, according to what this man Poe says, for the new universal. And that is, it would be in the direction of personality, the thing which is not explained by the old law. Isn't it funny then, just taking this man's article, but not just his article, but what obviously is the case in the direction of science, you can say two things. You can say the modern mechanical viewpoint as a final universal, a naturalistic science, a rationalistic science, is poor science. You can say the other thing, that the curious thing is, that beginning with what the early scientists really began with, and without which modern science wouldn't have started, and which is the historic Christian position of a personal beginning, and a God who creates an external universe, external to himself, therefore you know why things are, rather than why there's nothing. And because he's a personal God, and therefore a reasonable God, he creates a reasonable universe, and therefore you can pursue it with your own reason. The curious thing is that from a biblical viewpoint, you have a complete answer. And you would just say, maybe if you were in a discussion at this place, you'd just shrug your shoulders and say, isn't that strange? And that would be time to quit the discussion. Let him think it over for 24 hours. Then you'd be ready for the next discussion. But isn't that strange? Isn't it strange that if you pursue mechanistic, mechanical science, it turns out to be bad science because you don't explain the order of the universe and you don't explain the phenomena which you know, the part of the phenomena which you know best, and that is yourself and man in general. Isn't that strange? And yet the thing you have rejected in that started science in the first place, and that is the historic Christian viewpoint, would provide a super law which would keep the validity of the old law, namely that there is an area of the universe which does operate on the basis of cause and effect, and yet it would explain the phenomena that's not explained by this old law of science. It would be old then, it's modern science, naturalistic science, that explains the phenomena that was unexplained. I would just say, I think this is what Romans 1 means. I think men are really foolish. I think they're really foolish. I think it's exactly what Paul means. It isn't just that they're philosophically foolish. It isn't just that they're religiously foolish. But in the modern concept of science, they're scientifically foolish. They're scientifically foolish. Their viewpoint gives no explanation of personality. Personality is not at home in this universe because, as I've pointed out so many times, the only other explanation is the impersonal plus time plus chance. And nobody has demonstrated that time plus chance can produce any qualitative change. It can produce greater complexity, but no qualitative change. It can only produce quantitative changes. And if you begin with an impersonal, you end up with an impersonal, only with greater quantitative complexity. And that's all. There's no one who has shown, this is why modern man says he's dead. He doesn't find any way to be at home in the universe. He is unfulfillable in the universe that is. The Bible, on the other hand, sets forth a total universal, which I would say is now good science, as well as everything else. And the Bible claims that Christianity is a reasonable faith. It's not a leap in the dark. And that is, it starts with a personal universe. And if you begin with a personal universe, then that which we know best, this phenomena that's not explained by modern science, is adequately explained. Instead of it being something that is not at home in the universe, it is that which is intrinsically at home in the universe, because that's what always has been, namely, a personal beginning, a personal God. And then, of course, the second thing is the explanation of man. Man is made in God's image. So he isn't just a part of the mechanical universe. He's something very different. God can work into the unity of cause and effect when he will. He is not caught in a deterministic flow of a total field of cause and effect. And he has made man, so man isn't caught in it either. So the little man out in left field who decides, I'm not going to make $100 by throwing the game, I'm going to catch the ball, and he runs and catches the ball, he by an act of the personality interrupts the flow of cause and effect.
And here is a part of the phenomena that the scientist doesn't explain unless he makes this man in left field also a part of the deterministic system, and then suddenly man is dead. And that isn't the observation he makes of the phenomena of man. But the Christian viewpoint that man is really made in the image of God, and therefore he is non-programmed, and he can make up his mind to catch the ball, fits that which is the universal testimony of the whole human race. Which is amazing when you think of it this way. The testimony that we know through the artifacts, or everything, is that this is what man says he is and thinks he is. Modern man says, no, man is dead. So he says, oh, that's an illusion, in order to hold on to his rationalistic presuppositions and his naturalistic thinking. He denies the whole experience of the human race. But as soon as you take the biblical universal, to use this term now, the biblical super law, if you will, and you have a God creating a true universe of cause and effect, and yet man is made in his own image, so he is the particular outside of this. The curious thing is that's exactly what modern science has found, because modern science can explain everything else, but it can't explain man. And then the Bible says, why do you expect it? Isn't that what I said? Isn't man different? Man's made in the image of God. Man's relationship isn't just downward. Man's relationship is upward. On the side of personality, man is unique. Man is made in the image of God. And modern science finds that its mechanistic explanation explains the other particulars, but leaves this particular unexplained. Wouldn't you think, therefore, science, if it wasn't so orthodox in its rationalism and its the presuppositions of the uniformity of cause and effect in a total field, wouldn't you think it would do what it does in every other field, as this man Post indicates, and find the crack, and the crack is toward personality, and ask the question, is there a universal that covers this too, without denying the mechanical part of the universe? The curious thing is that the Christian universal, speaking of it this way for our lecture tonight, makes science itself scientific and sensible. The Christian universal makes science itself scientific. It explains the two parts of the universe, the mechanical section, and then the particular that's unexplained by the mechanical, by the uniform mechanical explanation, personality. At this particular point, you don't need to make a jump in the dark. Einstein had to make a jump in the dark. We don't have to make a jump in the dark. There's no jump in the dark. This is a universal that's stateable. It doesn't mean we exhaust the comprehension of it, but we can understand it. So here's a universal that's comprehensible by man, and it's stateable in a verbalized form. And once it's stated, just simply as a universal, the universal being an infinite personal God who is there and who has created the external universe outside of himself with real meaning and with this uniformity of cause and effect, and man, on the other hand, different, is made in his image. The curious thing is, as soon as you say this, there's no jump of faith needed in the sense of the Kierkegaardian jump in the dark. Suddenly, science is scientific. And it's rational. So in other words, the curious thing is, just as I point out in my philosophic lectures, is that you must make a choice. You must make a choice between rationalism and that which is rational. What is true in philosophy is proved also true in science. It's exactly parallel to the philosophy. As I point out in my philosophic lectures over and over again, classical philosophy hoped to hold on to a sense of rationalism that is beginning only with man and man-centeredness, and still give an explanation that it would be rational. And instead of that, he's come in a big circle and he's given up his rationality in order to maintain his rationalism. Well, curious thing is, scientists have done exactly the same thing in accepting in faith, as Einstein says, the order of the universe, even on the basis of their own presuppositions they have no explanation for. So they have, just like the philosopher, they have given up their rationality in order to be orthodox to their humanism and their rationalism. And I would simply say, this, therefore, is why naturalistic science is poor science. And on the other hand, following the scientific method, biblical Christianity can be good science. The biblical Christianity is rational and scientific, where naturalistic science has given up its rationality in order to hang on to its rationalism, and therefore it has denied its own scientific approach. So this is the conclusion for my lecture, and that is that naturalistic science is poor science. Biblical Christianity can lead us to good science. That biblical Christianity does not, even on a scientific basis, lead us to a jump in the dark. It leads us to a universal that does not deny the old laws of a true unity, a true flow of cause and effect in the material universe, and yet explains personality. So true Christianity is scientific, can be scientific. And instead of hanging on to one's rationalism and having to give up one's rationality, the curious thing is, with biblical Christianity, it's true, you're not rationalistic because you don't stand at the center of the universe. You're not humanistic. You do need some knowledge outside of yourself as far as returning to God is concerned. But on the other hand, one can have good science, and one can be rational. So I would just stress, say, I really think Paul understands something in Romans 1, not only about modern philosophy, who would rather say man is dead than to say God lives, but curiously enough, equally so with modern science.
What's the Christian view of science? Do we have any kind of unified view of science? Do we have a philosophy of science? Do we? Well, we should. We should have a philosophy of science. Now, without saying I'm exhausted tonight, but in this background, I would set forth for a few minutes, as I see it, what the Christian philosophy of science is. The first thing is that these other men say that nothing can disprove their religious thesis because it doesn't touch on the cosmology nor the history. And I urge any of you who are listening to this tape who haven't done so to pursue the lectures, the 18 lectures, if you can, the intellectual climate and the new theology at this point. We dealt with this with some, it's great length and with some detail. No cosmology, no history. So consequently, you cannot disprove these religious tenets, according to this. This is related, of course, to Kierkegaard, to Barth, and on, the jump into the dark. The old grandfather Huxley would have said there's no way to prove them. The emphasis is now is there's no way to disprove them. We quite agree, if that's all there is. Now, how do we begin holding the historic Christian faith? How do we begin? We begin by saying, and we must say it with absolute hardness, there is a way to disprove Christianity. There is a way to disprove Christianity. Christianity can be disproved in either the area of cosmology or of history. Christianity can be disproved either in the area of cosmology or of history, because we're dealing with objective facts. We're dealing with propositional truths. We're dealing with hard space-time stuff. So the first thing we would say as a philosophy of history, there is not a dichotomy. There is not a dichotomy. There's not an upstairs and a downstairs. It's not an upstairs and a downstairs. It just isn't so. There is a way to disprove Christianity. You can disprove Christianity by certain historic facts, or you could disprove Christianity by certain cosmological facts. And we would stand at this place along with the atheists to insist that if Christianity can't face up to cosmological facts,
propositional truths in the area of cosmology, and if it can't face up to the fact, to certain facts in the area of history, then we don't want to be Christians either. Now, until we have the courage to say that, we have forsaken the viewpoint of historic Christianity, and we have no real way of moving. We must not forsake our antecedents. Not because there are antecedents, but because this is the arena of truth. We do believe that in either cosmology or in history, there are certain things that could disprove Christianity. There is not an absolute dichotomy at all. Not at all. But, now here we come to the next step of what I think is an absolute basic thing that we need if we're going to have a Christian philosophy of history, of science. I beg your pardon. A Christian philosophy of science. And that is that there are certain things in either the cosmology or the history that could disprove Christianity. But rather than disproving Christianity, those of you taking notes, please get it all. But rather than disproving Christianity, that all the signposts of God's creation point toward the God of the Bible. Now here is, I think, the Christian philosophy of history. We're dealing with propositional truths. We're not dealing with either functional or psychological escape. This is what our forefathers believed, and surely this is where we sit. This is where we sit. We don't want to maintain Christianity on the level it's being maintained by Paul Tillich and the liberal Roman Catholics. If this is the way it has to be maintained, we'd rather see it sink. And if the human race has to sink with it, so that we have to stand by the beatnik artist and the beatnik poet, all right, let's stand there. The other thing you see is to try to escape the conflicts in the area of cosmology, in the area of history, by putting it in this upper story, thereby giving humanity a flute to play, when in reality there is no basis upon which either to stand to play it or to write your music or anything else. No tile over my head. No ground under my foot. Now, we don't believe that. We believe, I'm repeating myself because for those of you who may be hearing this on the tape who aren't used to our discussions here, I don't want you to miss what I'm saying. I'm not singing a song now. I'm trying to say something in propositional truths, in the area of propositional truth. I'm trying to say something in the common meaning of language and not a mystical meaning of language. I'm not talking in symbol. I'm talking in the hard stuff of historical grammatical meaning of language. First, we do believe there are some things in either the area of cosmology, that is science, or in the area of history that could disprove Christianity. And if we don't want an escape, we want the battle to be fought in this bloody field. This field where men have died for the truth. This field where men have died for the truth. We don't want to escape. We want to fight the battle where men have died for the truth. But, in our next step of a Christian philosophy of science, as I would see it, is the statement, however, we believe that all the signposts in God's created world point toward the God of the Bible. Now, don't take this lightly. Those of you who aren't used to our discussion here, maybe you don't realize it, but this is a very important point. We do not believe the external creation is neuter. We believe with Paul in Romans 1, with all our heart, that on the basis of the external creation and in the light of what man is, that the signposts point first that there is a creator, but also that we live in a personal universe. What is demanded is a personal God. In short, the God of Scripture. A personal, infinite God. And that means the God of the Old and the New Testament. Don't take this lightly. The battle is fought in the area of cosmology and history. Some things in either cosmology or in history could disprove Christianity. That was Paul's position. Paul's position is, if Christ was not raised physically, space-time-wise, in history from the dead, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. I've not said a thing Paul didn't say in that tremendous earth-shaking sentence. But along with Paul in Romans 1, we believe that the signposts of God's creation point toward the God of the Bible. Now then, a short time ago, we had a scientist visit us here. And man happens to be an expert in chemistry. Particularly related to the moment of experimentation in the area of sulfur. And he's a real born-again Christian. And he was here for some time, and just before he left, when we were sitting up in our room, and we finally got down to talking about a very central thing, and he said something very strenuous, very strenuously. He says, I believe that the edifice science is building has meaning. That may sound like a very simple sentence, but I suddenly realized that this man had said something that was very close to his own heart and thinking. Very important statement. This man said, I believe that the edifice that science is building has meaning. And he went on and said that he found that many Bible-believing Christians really didn't see much use for science and really didn't feel much force or much value in building the edifice that science is building. And this struck, of course, an immediate key with me, because it's very obvious here that we put much emphasis on the fact that all too often our dear brothers in Christ don't see any real meaning in culture as a whole. And, of course, science is just one part of a broad aspect of culture, using culture in this terminology. He went on and he said, I admit there's a lot of junk in the edifice that science is building, and he laughed because he's a scientist. There's a lot of junk in the edifice science is building, but I do believe it has validity. And I couldn't tell if he expected me to argue with him or not, the way he said it. But I didn't, because I agree with him. Now, this becomes of tremendous importance here. Should the Bible-believing Christians see any intrinsic good in building the edifice that science builds? Or should we just write it off and say, poof, there's nothing to it? Poof. They shot a rocket toward Venus. Poof. Double poof. What should be our attitude? I think we as Bible-believing Christians have to see something. We insist that the battle must be fought in the area of cosmology and in history. If this is true, then do you not see that from a Christian viewpoint, it does matter as science builds its edifice? It does matter. It's not the area that belongs to quotation marks them. It's the area that belongs to us. There is a lot of junk in the house that science building. That article in Life we read is part of the junk. Just plain junk from a scientific viewpoint. Good old-fashioned science that tear his hair, jump off the 32nd story, and be happy to die. To have such a thing named science. That isn't science. Whatever you're going to call it surely isn't science. It's just plain junk, to put it in this scientist's words. Because this man that was here is a real scientist. A real scientist. Lovely fellow who loves the Lord and a real scientist. And in his words, lots of junk in the edifice that science is building. And as I say, this is part of the junk. But we would agree with him that nevertheless, the edifice that science is building has validity. Now, to us, it is just part of the whole, as I say. We wouldn't see it here at Farrell House as just science as opposed to other cultures or other part of the culture. We would insist that the whole fabric of culture should have meaning to the Christian, and should have meaning in reference to redemption. But surely then we mustn't throw away the science. The science also has validity. The art has validity, the music has validity, the drama has validity. Christianity has something to say in judgment about each of these, and they can say something from a Christian viewpoint if they're done properly. But also it should be then true of science. I wonder how I can say it with all the force that I... As always, I'm not working from a manuscript here, and maybe I should have written this down to get what I want to say with force. These other people have turned over science to meaninglessness. They have put religion upstairs as a mystical existential experience dealing with a Sabellian concept of a God behind God, a silent God somehow or other, some form of pantheism. We insist that Christianity could be defeated if you turned up certain areas of cosmological fact or certain areas of history. These other men on the Roman Catholic side and the Protestant side, the new liberals, the new theologians, they have moved the religion upstairs where they say science and the cosmology and the history can't touch it. And then they breathe safely and they say, ha, ha, we escaped. And of course they haven't escaped anywhere. All they've got is paper people up here now. And they need new forms of symbolism, and then you need new totalitarian... a new totalitarian ministry to tell you who you are. We, on the other hand, say nothing, nothing at all, nothing at all. We stand with Paul. We stand with Paul. There are certain things in the area of cosmology, there are certain things in the area of history which could disprove Christianity. Well, then let me say with all that is in me, if we do not believe in a dichotomy between the things downstairs and the things upstairs, then Christianity must stand and have an interest in the comprehension of the downstairs. The liberals have a dichotomy into the upper and lower floors. But let us say with gentleness, gentleness and love. Too often the Bible-believing Christian has another form of dichotomy. He doesn't have any contact between his Christianity and culture as a whole or science. He may perform the acts of science, but almost without any Christian concepts. It's really a dichotomy. He might learn to crack the atom in the laboratory, but the only value is when he goes out and hands out a message of salvation. You'll say, wait a minute. Is there a meaning to science? Is science? That's just what this scientist was talking about here. There is validity from a Christian viewpoint in the edifice science is building. In other words, not that you should build a dichotomy now in just the opposite direction and spend all your time cracking atoms and don't care anything about people going to hell, of course. That isn't what he meant. But we've got to be careful not to be washed in the other direction. In other words, it can be a Christian act to find out six more things about the universe. It can be a Christian act to find out six more things about the universe. How? How? Now, we're just moving along in what I think is a Christian philosophy of science. Let's back off again to make it more forcible. As I pointed out in considering Richardson's study, this man from Nottingham who holds the new theological position, how carefully Richardson points out that he rejects Newton's view of the approaching the Bible on the basis of a cosmological study or history. And I've used the illustration at times, and it's valid here. I use it again. I'm sure Newton didn't wear a white coat in his laboratory. I'm saying this, Schaefer's saying this. Because I don't think there were white coats in their laboratories in those days. But let's, for a moment, in order just to get a picture in our mind, let's say that when Newton was functioning as a scientist, he wore a white coat. Now the point is, now Newton was a Christian. Newton was a real Christian. He's a real brother in Christ. The point is that Newton then, when he left his laboratory and opened his Bible to study either the areas that dealt with the cosmos or history, Newton would not have taken off his white coat. Now that's true. Newton wouldn't. Newton wouldn't. As Richardson pointed out that he wouldn't. And then Richardson says Newton made a tragic mistake. And we say, no, he didn't. Hooray for Newton. Keep on going, fella. Keep on your white coat. Now then, however, if we really think this, don't you see that it flows back in the other direction? It's important then when Newton finds out something about the cosmos in his laboratory. There must not be a dichotomy here. There must not be. I echo again what this man, this chemist, said. The edifice science is building has real validity. A lot of junk in it. You don't have to accept the junk. But the real stuff that they're finding out about the universe is not meaningless from a Christian viewpoint. Now then, as I listened to him talk, something fell into place. And I gave him what I thought was the answer to his dilemma. For he had a dilemma. He believed that science was built, the edifice that science was building, was valid, but he himself had never quite seen the direction. What is the validity? How does it fit into our total view? What really is the validity of the universe as science is opening to us, of the edifice science is opening. Now I'm down to within maybe a dozen sentences or 15 or 20 sentences of the conclusion of this. I've wrestled with this for a long, long time. It's not been a small area to me. It hasn't been so much science as it has been the general cultural subjects. But we've had a real group of men pass by here who are real scientists. As I have considered through these last years, with all my wrestlings in all these realms and talking to all these people from all these backgrounds, I think I see something. I'm going to give it to you at the end of this tape. I have a feeling it might be as an important thing as I've ever really felt and given. I'm not going to develop it completely here, but I think it's another one in the area where some of the young men who are scientists and so on can move on, philosophers. Maybe I'll wrestle with it further in some further...